What do you do when you're writing a novel set in 1968? Do you play the same keys as everybody else? Do you have hippies plant flowers into the barrel of a gun? Do you have the obligatory character who goes off to Vietnam? Do you dramatize the assassinations of Martin Luther King or Bobby Kennedy? 1968. This is the year that, even if you weren't alive, everybody seems to know. Mark Kurlansky wrote an entire book about it. But you can't escape the basic truth that this was a game-changing year in American history. But what do you do to avoid the clichés? Well, if you're Mark Sloka, you go to the places that history did not write about. You go to small towns populated by regular, working-class people who wouldn't have the bread to go to Woodstock. You write, in short, about life. You listen carefully to the people who didn't have the bullhorns. I'm going to confess that when I first read Mark Sloka's Brewster, his latest novel, I was a little suspicious of its narrative swagger. I mean, here was a book told from the story of a teenager named John Mosher, who seemed to talk just a little too tough. But as I read on, I realized that this was the point. Because if you're not part of the panorama that other people insist is the one to watch, aren't you going to speak a little louder? Aren't you going to be a little defensive? Isn't your story, the life that you lived, just as valid as someone who is ultimately part of the herd? Well, I talked about these things and more when I met Mark Sloka a few weeks ago to discuss his latest novel, Brewster, which I see that the Washington Post's Ron Charles has just deemed a masterpiece of winter sorrow. Sloka is also a regular contributor to Harper's, and we spent the last part of the conversation you're about to hear discussing one of his most notable essays, Quitting the Paint Factory, where the notions of life and leisure were openly challenged, and it dovetails quite nicely with what we talk about in relation to Brewster. Now, if you're just joining us, hello there, welcome! My name is Edward Champion, and this is the Bat Segundo Show. You can find more than 500 full-length conversations in our archive at batsegundo.com, B-A-T-S-E-G-U-N-D-O. I also want to thank FlavorWire's Jason Diamond, who recently named the Bat Segundo Show one of the top 25 best websites for literature lovers. Thanks for the shout-out, Jason. And if you enjoy this program, please let other people know about it. Rate us on iTunes, spread the word through social media, like us if that's what you like. Let other people know about us. This all helps to keep this program going and these very detailed and unique conversations happening. And now, here is our conversation with Mark Sloka. Okay, so I am here with Mark Sloka, who is most recently the author of Brewster. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So the book oscillates between one of Gandhi's most famous pacifist maxims. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And references to war, whether it be Vietnam or the World War I poet Wilfred Owen. And I'm wondering, just to get started here, how did this backdrop of war and peace help you to zero in on these characters in this landscape? Was this your way of tipping your hat to a socially charged time without hitting the obvious touchstones?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a matter of, you know, all politics is personal and vice versa. I was interested in writing about war because war is in the background, of course. Yeah. It takes place in the late 1960s, and, you know, the drums of Vietnam are going through the whole thing. But what I'm really writing about are the lives of these two young guys, 17, 18 years old, who are fighting a very different kind of private war, each in their own way, each with their own family, each with their own life. So the interplay, the sort of the back and forth between, you know, war kind of writ large and war, you know, lowercase is something that interested me, yeah.
This is a very violent book. There's a lot of smacking, slapping, and of course, the revelation near the end. I mean, it's pretty brutal. I mean, it's almost as violent as being in any kind of battlefield. And I'm wondering if the larger social canvas of Vietnam almost forced your hand when thinking about these characters to really consider this domestic abuse and all of this terrible pugilism that's going on underneath the surface.
I think so. I think it's probably unavoidable. I mean, I also grew up with guys like, let's say, this Ray Capiciano, Ray Cap character, who's, you know, who's fighting a very real war at home. I mean, his dad is an ex-cop, prison guard. He's not a good guy. But one of my favorite scenes, actually, in the book is a scene in the cafeteria where John, the narrator, is reading Wilfred Owen's poem about, you know, the trenches in World War One and the experience of watching someone die in a gas attack. And Ray Capp, who's sitting across the table, basically goads him into reading it out loud. And you know, it's like, I'm not going to read the damn poem. I said, read the poem. You know, eventually he reads the poem. And Ray responds to it in a way that's completely unexpected, even for him. And he responds to it probably because he understands on some deep, visceral level what it's like to be in battle, what it's like to be drawn to battle and not be able to get away from it. I mean, Owen was wounded, he recovered, and then he reenlisted, and then eventually died in the war. And Ray Capp is haunted by that because he's like, he went back? He went back to this thing and it eventually killed him?
Yeah.
That's his biggest fear, because he keeps going back to the house where he's, you know, where he has a hard life.
Yeah. Well, it's something that foreshadows his particular existence. He needs to have almost a poetic guide to understand the predicament that he's in, and he just
That's
can't
right.
understand why Owen would go back to serve after he's written this poem.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Well, I wanted to ask about, you know, how you depict this late 1960s Brewster as a different place from Woodstock across the river, a place where people really don't matter. I mean, they're expected to sort of fall in line. What kind of research did you do into Brewster of the late 1960s to develop this sense of what life is like, where, hey, you can be an individual all you want, but if you don't fall into line, you're going to have trouble living here?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, research for a writer often entails just talking to people, listening to people. There's this gorgeous New York area sort of vernacular that I just fell in love with reading, you know, writing this book. That Italian-American-Irish thing that I never wrote about. I grew up listening to it, and I never wrote about it, so this book was kind of a homecoming for me. The research I did was just sticking my nose out the door and listening to how people spoke, but I also had to remember a lot. And the truth is that the 60s didn't happen in the same way at the same time for all people. You know, one of the guys you know, that plays a role in this book is an Irish, you know, Catholic kid named Frank who's still listening to Perry Cuomo in 1968 because he is, because some people were. You know, Brewster in 1968 was still in 1957 in a lot of ways. And it was happening. Watts was happening. You know, Woodstock was across the river. But the day that Woodstock happens, my heroes end up going down to Yonkers.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to sit around listening to everything that they're missing, you know, across the river. And also because they're poor. These are working class kids. And a lot of working class kids didn't make it to Brewster because they didn't know that they'd open the fences. And it was 23 movie tickets, you know, to get into Woodstock. So they couldn't go. So they're fighting against a conservative, repressive, frightened culture that's all around them.
Yeah.
You know, some guy who's hitching up his office pants saying, yeah, I got a dream. You know, pay the goddamn mortgage.
But it is interesting that John, in telling this tale, doesn't really hit those touchstones. He says, well, we were more aware of the Tet Offensive than the nipples. You know, right?
Yeah,
but he doesn't actually really announce what they talked about, just kind of, you know, we talked about this. In fact, there's one point in the teen episode where he has a perfect memory of what he talks about with the hippies. But then when they leave, he can't remember a single subject of what he's talking about with Tina. And I find that really interesting. It's almost like despite the fact that he was well steeped in this, he can't remember that. And it's almost as if that doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah, well, that's part of it. I mean, he's also having sex, so
well,
it's like...
that does have a way of
erase the memory for a while, yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, it's you remember certain things, you don't others. I mean, I personally think the 60s didn't really become the 60s until 1980.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like then we looked back and we said, oh, that was the 60s. But when you were in it, you knew things were happening. And personally, I think the 60s were, in some ways, despite all the bullshit around the edges, and they've been sort of reduced to a fashion statement, the fact is that they were probably the last time that we really considered altering on a mass scale what our priorities are in this country and how we, you know, how we would proceed. It didn't work. It didn't happen. But something's happened. It was an exciting time. So these guys knew that things were happening. They could hear it happening, but it wasn't happening in Brewster. And yeah. That's part of the tension in the book.
Going back to what you were saying earlier about how you made Brewster come alive, you say that you stuck your nose out the door, but you're also competing with memory. And you're dealing with who is still alive, who lived through that time, versus what you remember. I mean, at what point do you have to throw that aside and just rely on your own instinct or imagination for what you feel Brewster is or should be? I mean, you know, how do you wrestle with all this?
I think you have to throw it out very early. You just have to go by instinct. You just walk in. You know, you create a place that feels right on the page, that feels right as that feels like a place that you can inhabit as a writer and believe in as a writer. And if you get that right, then eerily enough, I think you get close to something that's actually believable for other people. And it's kind of a counterintuitive sort of thing. You're following your own instincts. Why would someone else understand that? You know, and sometimes they don't. But in my experience, if you trust yourself, you know, and you make mistakes, you try to correct them and so on. But by the time you're done, if you've trusted yourself and if you've sort of followed those instincts, then there's a really good chance that other people will sense that there's a sort of an organic quality to that imaginative thing that you've wrought, and they'll buy into it, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about this. I mean, how many people did you talk with, and if you're hearing another perspective of that particular time, how does this mesh with you trusting yourself as a writer, you trusting that truth, that perspective, that world that you were planting and growing in the book?
I think for me, listening, when I talk about listening to people, It's not about listening to their stories necessarily, though people will tell you their stories, and I love to hear them. It's about listening to how they talk. It's about listening to, you know, I love the way people talk down there. It's you know, I was getting some beer at the AMP recently, and I asked this kid, I said, you know, where's the beer at? And he said, well, okay, you go to the back, you hook a right. And I was walking away. I said, thanks, I'm walking away. And he said, it's the only thing I know where it is in the store. Well, if you write that down on paper, it's the only thing I know where it is in the store. It's a mess. The sentence is a disaster, but it's beautiful too.
Yeah.
There's a kind of a poetry to it, and that could be expanded infinitely. So for me, it was a matter of imagining this place. I had certain bones I needed to pick with my own past, with the memories of people that I knew back then. You're trying to resolve certain things that aren't completely clear to you, even as you're writing them, except that you know you have to write them. But the research involves just opening your ears, which I did for the first time in this. I never wrote an American book before. This is my first truly American book. It was just a question of giving myself permission to say to myself, look, you were born and raised in this country. You've listened to these people for 50 years. Just shut up and write. And I tried to do that, and hopefully it worked out.
It seems to me, I'm going to just infer here, maybe you can clear this up, if you had a bone to pick with yourself, maybe some of these interesting sentences that you hear at the A&P or that you hear from people telling you about the period, maybe it's a way to sort of get outside of yourself or to kind of plant almost a, I guess, what might be called almost a more objective voice because you have something more concrete to work with. Is that
I think, no, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what it was, really. It's, I mean, this book is a homecoming. It's, you know, I lost my father the day after this book was finished, literally, and he was the storyteller in my life. We had our hard times. You know, he drank when I was a kid. The last 15 years were great. But I spent most of my writing life writing stories that were set elsewhere. They were from my parents' times. They were the resistance in Prague during the Second World War. It was ancient Siam, the Siamese twins, da-da-da. This was the first, you know, it's time to write my own story. Not that those weren't, but this one's my own in a different way. I mean, I think there's something about listening, about coming home to Brewster, which is a difficult place to explain, though I'm fond of it.
Well, let's talk about this, because in The Visible World, your narrator is a child of Czech refugees from World War II.
not unlike yourself. In Brewster, John's family is Jewish. They have escaped from Germany. You have Frank, who we just talked about earlier, comes from Poland. You have Karen, even from Hartford, on a more limited scale. You have Ray talking with the woman behind the cafeteria. So there is very much a quality to your fictitious characters in which they always come from somewhere else, or they're not defined by the place they live right now. And I was wondering why that's your affinity.
Do you think that comes from?
Well, not necessarily where that comes from, but I mean, do you feel that it's truer to write about someone, or more, you know, you're going to get a more dimensional character if they have some kind of additional background that no one is really from anywhere?
Oh God, you're good at this. The problem is that it's me. I'm the one who's not really from one place or another. You know what I mean? I grew up on the fault line between two cultures, two languages, two histories. I grew up in a Czech ghetto in Queens, New York, for Christ's sake, right? So my first language was Czech. I didn't speak English until I was five, and I went out on the playground and had to figure out what the hell was going on and why these kids weren't speaking Czech. My problem is, and that's just my life, is that with the possible exception of a little cabin that we have in a place called Lost Lake, I've never really had a home. So, and whenever I was in one place, I was always looking for the next good place, the next place, and the next place. That's one of the problems for me with getting older, is that you're running out of time to look for the next place, and the next place, and the next place. So I think I've transferred a lot of that kind of restlessness, which I think is very American, actually. Yeah. Americans are always looking for the next great place. I've transferred that restlessness into my characters, who are usually from everywhere but here. I mean, it's possible that actually Brewster is the most grounded of my books, because these kids are from there. Though it's also kind of ironic that they're also the most trapped. I mean, they're from Brewster and they want to get the hell out.
Yeah.
Again, not unlike me. It's like, I'm here, how soon can I leave?
But it's also bizarre that the one type of heritage they have in this case that's shared with everybody is this Nazi memorabilia, which we see later on, which is almost like, well, if you really want to go to the past and see human evil strength and look at them in the face, here it is. I mean, it's almost as if, I guess what I'm wondering is like, you know, you're not a novice writer here, so why not explore the ground? Or is this really the best you can do right now in terms of Brewster, in terms of being planted here in this particular town? This is as grounded as you can write about at this time in your life.
I think so. I really do. I'm the child of refugees. I'm the child of Czech refugees who escaped their country, who mourned the loss, who probably handed down a hefty dose of that kind of spirit, feeling, instinct. I think that's kind of my fingerprint as a writer is that I'm sort of dealing with the diaspora, you know, of whatever form that diaspora takes place. I'm trying to get at that, the lives that are lived on some sort of a borderline between actuality and desire, maybe between, you know, an old history that you've been handed down, like John Mosier's. He inherits that survivor's guilt from his parents. They escaped out of Germany in the nick of time through a closing door. You know, then they suffer a second loss. So he's inherited that, but he's trying to break free of that thing. I guess it's fascinating talking to you, because I'm in a sense getting a certain insight into my own predilections or tendencies, hang-ups. I guess I am always writing about characters who are kind of geographically fraught, you know, historically.
But it's very clear to me that the bright bulb of heritage is basically the bookends of Brewster. We start off with a broken lamp that's found in the streets, and then we end with a light bulb. I don't think that gives anything away. I mean, it seems to me that this is the very clear subconscious indicator. Hey, Mark, why don't you write about my heritage? And yet, you know, there it is, personified perhaps unintentionally by symbolism, and yet here we are talking, and I'm sort of telling you, well, look, all your characters are from somewhere else.
Yeah, they are. Well, you know, but the thing is that, I mean, I have this notion, I mean, people think that we write books. We don't write books. The books write us.
Yeah.
They really do. And I've had revelations about this novel that came to me in the shower, you know, months after the book was written. It's like, oh my God, I hadn't known I was doing that. But I was answering certain things, resolving certain things, thankfully without being aware of it, because if I'd been aware of it, then I would have contorted the book to somehow fit that, and it would have been a lesser book for it.
Yeah. Maybe another way to look at this issue is, because I did find out that you have crossed America 22 times with your family, presumably with your lovely daughter here in town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, what has that done for you to Sound Novels Productions? What has that done for you as a writer and as a person? How has this helped you to understand this kind of wandering instinct you seem to have?
I'll tell you what it's done for me. It's given me a lot of good stories to tell around the bar.
Ah,
you know, you
yes.
and I could talk for a long time. We have stayed as a family with our dog and our cats and the boa constrictors and the rats to feed the boa constrictors and the box turtles and all the rest of our menagerie. We've stayed in more Motel 6s than I care to think of. And what's interesting about the Motel 6 is that it's kind of a gathering spot for a certain cross-section of Americans.
And to carry on the light bulb further, we'll leave the light on for you.
Yeah, we'll leave the light on.
Yeah,
there you go.
Motel 6 is your muse.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this is amazing. Yeah, no, there it is. I must have been there. That Motel 6 was talking to me as I was writing.
They should pay you something.
I think so. I think so. We need to talk to them
anyway,
after this. So, you know, we'd stay in the Motel 6, and you're you know, I was whatever. I'm teaching at the University of Chicago, or I'm a teaching fellow at Harvard, or whatever. And but there you are, and you're in the swimming pool with the guy next to you, and he's got the tats, and he's got his little kids jumping over other people's heads, and you have to talk, you communicate. And what I found is that all of my expectations are confounded on a regular basis. So the guy who looks like he could, you know, kill your whole family ends up holding the gate for you as you're walking into the pool. Or he's the one with the most polite kids. He said, you know, I told you not to jump over Bobby's head. You know, that's 30 seconds timeout. You got to sit on the side. It's just, it gives you a kind of a photograph of America, a very complex photograph of America, which I've grown to love over time. I mean, it's this country is confounding and maddening and endlessly complex. And I've tried to, I guess, in some way, I've begun to channel a lot of that back, those 22 trips worth with Maya and her mom and you know, her brother. I've begun to channel that into my writing, finally.
Yeah.
Took me a long time to get to it, but better late than never, right?
So, so really, it was less defined by place and more defined by really knowing the variegated soul, so to speak, of America, these trips.
I'd like to think so. I mean, you know, there's that great Dylan song, you know, it's like stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again, right? I don't know, but it seems to me there were probably four kids in America back in the late 60s who didn't substitute the name of their own hometown for Mobile.
Yeah.
Right? Well, my guys do that, you know, stuck inside of Brewster with the Memphis Blues again. It says, Brewster is the town that other people pass through on the way to somewhere nicer. I mean, I live there. I love the place, but it is. You know, it's got sharp elbows. It can be hard to love, but it's authentic. And I would hope, if I got it right, and it's not for me to say, but if I got it right, people would be able to read this book in Kansas or in Oregon or whatever, and say, yeah, no, I know that town.
Yeah,
you know, I know that town. That's not so much different from the town that I grew up in, with all of its problems and all of its issues.
Why do you think small towns tend to get a bad rap in contemporary literature, especially the American novel these days? I mean, there used to be a time when you had the influence of Sherwood Anderson. And today, you know, you've got Richard Russo, you've got a couple people working these little small areas. But, you know, by and large, my feeling, especially in the last couple of years where you have endless novels about New York, you know,
a lot
the
of
small
them.
town gets a bad rap. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think it's sort of like writing about adolescence, right? I mean, it's easy to condescend. It's one of the things I really had to struggle with. I mean, when you're 55 and you're looking back on being 17, it's easy to say, oh my God, what a pissant I was. You know, what did I know? And it's true, and it's not. The fact is that when you're 17, there are certain things that you see and feel, most of all, that are authentic for that time, and if you're going to write about them, you have to respect them. Same thing is true for small towns. I think it's easy to condescend because there's a lot to condescend about. You know, there. I mean, you know, the culture can be lacking, the people can be conservative as hell, they can be bigoted, they can be stupid, they can be violent, all the rest of it. But they're not, as a rule. You know, are there bigoted, you know, idiots in Brewster right now? You bet. You know, quite a collection. Are there absolutely terrific human beings who don't fit that profile at all in Brewster today? Yes, there are. So, and I think that's true for every town in America. It's I think the reason we're not seeing more books about small towns in America that don't either kind of smear Vaseline all over the lens and make it seem like Paradise Lost, or, you know, do that sort of that David Lynch sort of, you know,
small towns are weird,
dark underbelly bullshit, which I never liked, because I think it's just such a cop out in some ways. It's like, oh yeah, it's the dark underbelly, but I mean, you haven't seen that. I think it's easy to swing to one extreme or the other, and they're both equally forms of condescension. I think if you're painting it in rainbow hues or if you're painting it black, it's condescension either way.
So how do you avoid that with this? Because Brewster does have a dark underbelly. I mean, the way that all the violence I was mentioning earlier, I mean, that's pretty dark shit.
It is dark shit. Hey, God, you know, it's, again, maybe I've fallen into that trap. I'd like to hope not.
Well, maybe it's not so bad.
And maybe it's unavoidable, and maybe it's not so bad. I think that I try to avoid it, at least, by kind of grounding, you know, the dark shit, as you said, in something that's historically viable and believable. In other words, people did bring things back from the Second World War. Some of them were pretty horrible little artifacts. People are bigoted in certain ways, or they certainly were in 69 in a much more sort of naked way than they might be today. I try to court complexity. I do. I try to look for characters I try to create characters who aren't one thing, because there are no such creatures on the planet. You know, the worst character in my book is someone who is scared inside. He's a frightened man, and I wanted to get at that fear, and I wanted to get at his sense of insecurity and his sense of what makes him terrifying is that he's terrified.
Yeah.
In certain ways. So I'm trying to complicate the picture of the all American small town that
so
way.
You can avoid the ultra impulses that you despise, the David Lynch-style form of small town, by making every dark character in your book, imbuing that character with a human quality, with something that, oh, well, we could all go down that road if we're not careful.
Well, isn't that what makes them really scary, is that there's some part of them that we can identify with?
Yeah.
That makes a person really terrifying, because suddenly you see something inside yourself, and you realize, oh, you know, they're but four, whatever, you know, I could.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I'm going to propose that you have perhaps knowingly or subconsciously done something even more unsettling. And that is, we know more about the root cause of Ray's dad by the end of this book than we know about John's mother, who is, there's this terrible diabolical moment. She's contending with grief, but we don't quite know why she's held onto it for so long and why she continues to just almost ignore John or fall asleep in various places. I mean, there's one harrowing moment where John goes up to her and says, "Why do you hate me?" And there's another moment where he comes with a birthday cake, and that is just so just crushing for both of them. And yet we never, I mean, we're kind of left with some enigma at the end of that, even though we actually understand Ray's dad more. And John comes away at the end of this book sort of brushing off his mother somewhat, I would think.
I'm
wondering, you know, that to me is deeply terrifying, to have to go to someone else who is perhaps even worse than your own parents and find something to commiserate about them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that somebody pointed this out to me after the book was written. Another one of those things that I didn't realize I was doing when I was doing them.
Yeah.
Each of the boys finds a certain amount of approval in the other's family.
Yes.
That they themselves can't get. In other words, Ray, who has this horrific relationship to his father, is kind of taken in by John's family.
Yeah.
And he's acknowledged by John's family in a way that they can't acknowledge their own son, John. And John, in turn, is kind of respected by Ray's dad, and treated decently in a way that he can't treat his own son. And I think that happens a lot. Often we find it very difficult to, or certain families, certain relationships, we find it difficult to be decent to those who are closest to us. It's easier to be decent to someone you don't know so well. The problem with Ray, with John's mother, not to get too confessional here, is that, I mean, John's mother is my mother, to a great extent. She and I had an extraordinarily complex and difficult relationship. And part of what happened was that, you know, as she sort of slid headlong into overwhelming depression, she was always mourning the son that she lost, me. And I spent 20 years sort of trying to break through, saying, I'm right here. I'm standing right in front of you. I haven't changed. I'm the same. I'm not four anymore. I'm yeah. 8 or I'm 12 or I'm 16, but I'm the same guy. And I didn't realize until I'd finished this book that what I did in Brewster, in John's case, is that I kind of literalized my family life. I mean, John's idealized brother dies, and he has to live in the sort of the shadow of that loss. Well, my idealized younger self, my four-year-old self, vanished from the earth, and I had to try to live with the fact that I wasn't four and adorable anymore, but I was like 13 and I had pimples on my chin. And so if John's mother ultimately is unknowable on some level, if we understand her less, maybe it's because I'm still trying to figure out, you know, what happened to me. Whereas Ray's dad is someone I can somehow grasp onto more.
I also wanted to ask you about one descriptive motif throughout the book. It's there in the very first page when we're introduced to Ray, basically pressing his finger along the fin. And throughout the book, you know, warm wood, constant brushing of fingers through surface, and even later in the book through that plastic bag, which almost kind of seems to be a foreshadowing that it set up earlier with the whole graduate plastics warning.
Wow.
And I'm wondering why how the texture helped you to form the world and to get these characters supplanted in Brewster like this. You know, I was wondering.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Because hands is very frequent. I mean, I think the word hands is maybe the most frequent word in the book, if not...
See, that's so interesting. It's another one of these, I'm telling you, books write us. The only answer I can give you is that I guess I think of myself... I don't know that anybody else would ever think of me that way, but I think of myself as a kind of a physical writer. The physical world, the world of smells, of touch, of the senses in general, mean a great deal to me. I'm kind of grounded in the sensual world, and in order for my writing to work to my satisfaction, the writing has to be, you know, the smell of wet cement, you know, the smell of cut grass on that evening in July when, you know, the water's just the right temperature and this gaudy moon is rising over the trees. I mean, I work very hard to get at the physical, because I think the physical is our door to memory. Mm-hmm. If you really want that memory to blossom in the reader's mind, the way to get at them is through a scent, through a touch, through, you know, you want the 1960s, you see some guy in long hair and long black coat, he's just had a fight in a wintry, you know, parking lot, and as he's walking away, because he's such a tough little bastard, you know, he just lazily runs his finger along the tail fin of some car.
Yeah.
And it's the tail fin that anchors it, and you can feel the smoothness of the, you know, of that fin underneath his finger, and hope, if I get it right, it's a big if I get it right, you're there. If I don't get the physical right,
I think you got it right, but as a reader, my takeaway in that description and other descriptions of Ray was that here is a guy who goes from something unspeakably violent to casual conversation in an instant. And it's sometimes marked by that brush of the finger, and it's sometimes marked by just what he says casually to one of his friends. And that's what I got from that. I mean, the finger almost pointed to the fact that this guy, there's no... there's no real time for transition between these two worlds, and that's what makes him this fatalistic character, you know?
Yeah, to me, it's what makes him fascinating. I mean, again, he's based on this guy that I knew who was, you know, guys, Jesus, they're such a mess, especially a certain kind of, like, Italian-American, you know, hetero guy, that often they'll talk a lot, you know, they'll be the, like, yeah, you know, they'll push and shove. But every now and then you run into someone who cuts all that shit loose. I mean, he'll hit you before you know it. I mean, the transition is, there's no transition. Ray Kapp is that guy. He's not going to talk. He'll hit you first. The thing that makes him interesting to me is not just that there's that lack of respect, that lack of, he just transitions like this, but that underneath all of that is a decent soul. The guy that I knew as a kid growing up had a little brother named Gene, just like Ray Kapp in the story. I swear he would have laid down on the tracks for this kid. And he loved that boy. He was a kid. His brother was 12 years younger, 12, 13 years younger.
Yeah.
And as a 14-year-old looking at this, I was hugely impressed by that kind of love because I'd never seen that before. Here's a very tough kid who's taken a lot of shit, a lot more than he deserves. And yet he'll do anything for this little snotty 3-year-old baby brother of his. Anything. And so there's a violence there that's undeniable. There's a hair trigger kind of, you know, brawler's instinct that's there. And yet, you know, 7 layers underneath that is complexity, is someone who's capable of love, someone who's capable of loyalty, someone who's desperately fighting to escape his own circumstances. That's where I live as a writer, in that place where it gets confusing, where it gets contradictory.
Here's a question for you. I mean, you were saying earlier that a lot of truths came to you during the writing of this book and when the book was done. And one thing that is fascinating about Ray is that, in many ways, he is a victim of belief culture. People believe that he has these fights, and I won't spoil the book, but what we come to learn about what's really happening is quite astonishing, because if you connect the dots, and if you even just look a little bit, anybody should be able to, yeah, anybody living in Brewster should be able to figure out that there's a problem. And of course, there's the fact that Ray's dad is a former cop, and even when the cops come, there's that going on. It goes back to what I was suggesting earlier about what you're doing here with small towns. But I am curious, you know, on some level, maybe in hindsight, do you think that Ray is partially responsible for that belief culture coming into place? Or does this blame... Could we lay this on people like John, maybe that's why he's telling the story, or the people who were surrounding him?
I think it's both, really. I think Ray is creating a fiction about himself, which, like most fictions we create about ourselves, are not 100% fictions. They're only partial fictions. They're rooted in some kind of truth. But the second part of your kind of tentative answer to the question is equally accurate. I mean, people will believe what they want to believe. In fact, I think Ray says that at some point. People only believe what they want to believe. And they won't see what's right in front of their faces unless it fits some preconceived notion of what it is they think they ought to see, which is right in front of their faces. So, again, being who I am, I guess, and thinking the odd way that I think, I immediately expand that into something bigger, and I think, well, but isn't that a good metaphor for our lives? I mean, we only see ourselves in the rearview mirror, right? We only know who we are and why we behave that way and what we did, maybe, if we're lucky, after we've passed it. And then I can expand that a little bit further and say, well, again, it's part of my pet philosophy. It seems to me that that's where fiction comes in, as a way of explaining ourselves to ourselves. Because I think a certain thing happens, but as soon as it's happened, it enters the domain of fiction. Like, if you tell me what you did this morning, it'll be a work of fiction, because you'll leave certain things out, you'll stress certain things that you think are more interesting.
You'll enhance. You may even unknowingly lie about something.
You'll even unknowingly lie. You're in the domain of fiction.
Yeah.
So everything that happens to us, as soon as it's done, comes into that world. And it's all, and you know, his, that's where history comes from. You know, it's kind of pounded into the fool's gold of history. That's how we know ourselves, through the telling of stories. But those stories are necessarily retrospective. You don't tell the story as you're living it. You're living it, and then you tell the story.
And now I have the absolute explanation for why you keep those misspellings of your name on the refrigerator. Because it actually happened. It can actually match up with your fiction brain.
Oh, absolutely.
You don't have to worry about that. Look, there's the physical tangible evidence.
I think we're up to 32 or 33, some ungodly number now.
Wow.
It's been growing because we went back to this box where I've been tossing them when we clipped them all out. And now we've got 32 misspellings. I don't know why I keep these things. You know, Mark Sluka, Mark Slanka, Stanka, Stinga. Olark Stoka was my favorite, I think.
Is this a way to basically ensure that there is no fridge magnet poetry on the fridge?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, just exile
those magnets.
The
fridges are meant to be opened, and it's sort of a shameful kind of thing.
I
wanted to go into how this book deals with race. I think it deals with it very interestingly, because on one hand, you have these kids paying attention to the news, as we established. John compares it to listening in on a party line. Then you have African-American kids who were bussed in from Yonkers into Brewster. And Harry, the biggest kid in the school, he unsuccessfully tries to confront this kid who didn't close the door. And it's quite astonishing what happens to him. There's also this trip to Yonkers that you were mentioning earlier where they go down there. There's the concern about locked doors, which is, your timing is excellent because of Obama's speech in relation to Trayvon Martin, where he was talking about the whole locked doors thing that symbolizes racism. You know, I'm wondering, first and foremost, were there any specific desegregation cases in Brewster which you drew upon? Or was this kind of your way of trying to align Brewster with the larger national fabric of what was going on with race? I mean, at a few points, John mentions like other riots going on, but they're mere names. And until he actually sees this experience in front of him, he realizes, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to confront this too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there were specific cases. I mean, I ended up spending a good part of my high school in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Bethlehem, Allentown. And there were bust kids coming in. Black kids, Puerto Rican kids. They were like a separate world. You know, I mean, there has been real progress in the last 35, 40 years. It's maybe not that visible, especially in light of recent events.
Yeah.
And God knows we have a long way to go. But
sure.
The fact is that back then, we didn't know how to talk to them, and they didn't know how to talk to us. And there were a lot of people who felt very threatened, very uncomfortable. They didn't know what was going on. And this is Mississippi. This is, you know, this is Pennsylvania. Never mind.
What were you going to say there, sir?
I was going to say something about Pennsylvania, sort of, you know, being the Mississippi of, you know, of the North, but that's another story. I was not fond of Bethlehem particularly, or my years there. It just seems to me that what I tried to do in the novel was remember what it felt like to first, as a white kid, you know, growing up in a sort of Jewish, Irish, Italian world, Czech, you know, refugees, but they were all white. You know, we were white, really white. And suddenly you've got this other world coming in, which felt like another world. We didn't realize it wasn't another world, really. It was just, guess what? You know, this kid's like you. So in the novel, what I tried to get at was the range of relationships you had. So when my guy is at the 168th Street Armory in the city, you know, and he's watching this mile relay being run magnificently by these inner city kids, these black kids from Boys High, he doesn't think, oh my God, there are these African American, you know, runners running. He thinks, Jesus, what a great race. So at the same time, though, when kids like that are bussed into Brewster, it creates certain tensions. You still hear a lot of racist talk in Brewster. It's unbelievable. I mean, if you really go out and you go out as a white man and they don't know who you are yet, sometimes people just assume that you're one of the tribe. It's kind of stunning. It's, you know, history lurches forward, you know, like two steps forward, hopefully, you know, now and then two steps back, too. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. I wanted to also talk about some of your nonfiction. In your essay, Quitting the Paint Factory, you write that you distrust the perpetually busy. You call them soul eaters. Nearly a decade later, that essay was written in 2004, people are quite possibly more workaholic by circumstance, and time to consider options these days is ever more at a premium. So I wanted to, you know, follow up on this and ask you if leisure has been co-opted by capitalism. I mean, how can idlers co-opt leisure back? I mean, how can anyone take a stab at aliveness like Sherwood Anderson when the demands for labor are now higher than they have ever been before and wages are so low?
I think it's I think you're going to have to fight and claw for it every inch of the way. I do think that leisure has been co-opted by capitalism. Consumer capitalism runs the world.
Yeah.
In infinitely complicated ways that are continually more and more enveloping. I think technology, by and large, is a brilliant way of kind of co-opting our inner space, our imaginative space, the dialogues that we have in our heads. Because if I'm tanking up the car, I have to watch a TV now. If I'm sitting in the airport, I have to watch a TV now. If I'm in a restaurant, I have to watch a TV now, and so on and so forth. Now we have, you know, these devices in our hands, which are sort of infinitely usable and helpful, but we're losing ourselves in the process. I think, you know, it sounds absurd, but I believe it. I think we're being colonized, in a sense, by our own machines. Which are hugely helpful to us, and that's precisely why they're so dangerous. The inner life is being encroached on like some little piece of turf that's being sort of, you know, hemmed in by pavement. And the human is slipping out of the equation. I mean, how many people have tried to phone some business to try to correct a bill or something, and they're following the phone tree, and there's not a human being to be found? And, you know, after a half an hour of frustration, you end up getting something that doesn't help you. And if you find a human somewhere, you'll say, oh, my God, thank God. And you explain your problem, and it's solved in 30 seconds. Well, we're not going that way. We're going the other way. We're going toward ever-increasing mechanization. And I worry about that. I think that one of the things that we're losing is leisure time, and leisure time is where you become a political person. Because it gives you the time to figure out what the hell you believe, what might be worth fighting for, and how to do it. If you don't have that, you're perfect. You're going to go out there and you're going to be working like a dog, and then you'll buy all the crap that you need to buy in order to keep the economy growing, and the machine just keeps rolling.
But some who were tweeting during the Arab Spring and during Iran would argue with you and say, well, if I had not had this way of getting the message across, my politics would have been lost in the dust.
And they'd be absolutely right.
Yeah.
The thing that makes these technologies so dangerous is that they are useful. They are incredibly useful, helpful. I mean, they're minor miracles that you can now carry in your pocket. So it's not, I mean, they wouldn't be dangerous if they weren't so good at what they do. But it's precisely because they're so good at what they do that they tend to block out everything that they're taking away from us. And one of those, I mean, I've seen it in my students. My students, you know, the attention deficit disorder, whatever you want to call it, which I think is nationwide, we're scattered all over.
What were you saying?
Yeah. there, you know. Yeah. yeah.
No, I am paying attention, don't worry.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't know who I am. I need to check my cell. I mean, I think it's, I can see it. I can see from a certain perspective, if you were to enter this culture, you know, from Mars and look around, you would think that the population was a population of addicts to a great extent. We're nervous, we're jittery, we can't, you know, it's the first thing we do when we wake up, the last thing we do before we go to sleep, it's what we do when we're eating, it's what we do when we're talking, it's what we do. We're often doing 12 things at the same time. We can't stop. And the fact that we can't stop is a sign. I mean, it's a sign that we need to take back some of our own. And to answer your question, long-winded answer to a very simple question.
That's
okay. How do we take back some of that territory for ourselves?
Well, maybe a way of actually posing this is, what is true leisure to you? What would be leisure that is acceptable under the Sloka label?
Whatever's unwired, unmediated, you're either in the presence of your own mind, you're listening to some music while cooking dinner, you're having a conversation.
Multitasking, though.
Yeah, it is. That's yes, there we go. Yeah, there we go.
See,
but it's close enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'll buy it. It's not great. You should probably turn off the music. You know, it's a face-to-face conversation like you and I are having now, like two people in a room talking, because I think there are certain kinds of communication that occur when two people actually are in the same space that are just, it's not the same as Facebook. It's just not. I mean, Facebook, again, is hugely useful as a way for people to keep in touch, blah, blah, blah. But what's being lost is this really wide bandwidth kind of communication, which takes place on a whole lot of different levels. I think single tasking is the wave of the future. I think that's that people are going to begin to feel, they're already feeling the loss. I mean, you know, depression levels are through the roof, sleeplessness is through the roof. Yeah.
And suicides
are through the roof. And all of these things have coincided, surprise, surprise, with the last 15, 20 years of rapid technological, you know, development. There's a correlation. It's unmistakable.
Then how do you account for the fact that I listen to 4-hour podcasts from Dan mm-hmm. Carlin on the Spanish-American War, which is a great stuff. Well, it's fun, but and it's really informative, but it's also a great irony or possibly a duality that we're going to this medium that is allegedly tearing us apart, that I'm contributing. A lot of people who are listening to this are mm-hmm. also part of that.
Sure.
We're talking about...
I'm part of it.
Yeah, we're talking about a book which requires 5 or 6 hours of your time. You know, how do you account for things like this where multi-hour chunks of time are somehow aligned with this ever-increasing distraction world? I mean, doesn't that count as a kind of acceptable compromise for leisure? I'm just wondering.
I think it does count, yeah, because I think when you're listening to those... you know, when you're listening to those whatever they were, podcasts or whatever, about the Spanish-American War.
Dan Carlin, it was really... I was in a lake in the middle of nowhere, and I just started listening. I couldn't stop.
See, but that's terrific, because it's you and his voice telling you something. So there's an extended communication going on. If someone picks up my book, hopefully there's a certain silence where they're kind of talking to the book as the book is talking to them. There's something magical that happens in the act of reading that some people have written very beautifully about. But it's powerful to the building of an individual self, of an actual idiosyncratic human being, because you're made up of all the books you've read over many, many years, which shape you in ways that you yourself don't perhaps completely understand. Those are all legitimate. What I mean, it's not up to me to say what's legit and what isn't, but to my mind, those are helpful ways of being because they allow you to think, to be still, to imagine, to contemplate. They allow your mind to go off on little tangents and riffs and connect things up in certain ways. But if that inner space, that imaginative space, is being constantly fractured, splintered, broken into smaller and smaller pieces, 2 seconds for that, 1 second for that, 30 seconds of this, there's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, I think the result is some kind of psychic damage. I really do, especially over time.
Yeah, but you also declared war on the perpetually busy, and as someone who is very busy and often works 12 to 16-hour days...
Me too, more than I love.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah. Hey, then you're... Yeah, basically, yeah. You're eating your own soul. I mean, I'm just trying to understand because I think you and I... It sounds like we both do what we love. Yeah. And how do you define the difference between work and leisure? I mean, how does this become a problem if work encroaches upon what you love doing or what actually causes you to have those fleeting associations or that kind of rumination time and all that?
Well, I mean, in the essay that you referred to, Quitting the Paint Factory, you know, I refer to something called the Church of Work.
Yes.
I think you put your finger on the vital distinction, and that is if you're doing something that truly gives you pleasure, that you find meaningful, that you've come to some sort of terms with in the sense that, you know, there are other things still possible for you, other things that give you pleasure, other things that you can do, and this is a vital part of that life, then I think, you know, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. You know, it's like, you're good. But that's not necessarily what I see around me. I see people who, I mean, it's statistically sort of borne out. I mean, people are working harder than they ever have before.
Sure.
And Brewster, I'm surrounded by people who work like dogs, but then again, they also have absolutely everything and all the trimmings and all the latest stuff, and you know, and so for them, sometimes when you hear them say, "Oh no, I need to work," you know, I need to keep going forever and ever. You say, "Well, yeah, but I mean, if you just consider what you could take away, then." look at that. You've suddenly made room for a certain amount of leisure time. I mean, like...
So we're getting transcendentalist here.
Well, we're kind of trading stuff for life, is how I see it. It's like, okay, I don't have the... I'm not going to get the Mercedes, but that's just bought me a year's worth of time, or, you know, six months of leisure, of something else. So it's a trade-off. You have to make the decision in your life. But the culture is constantly pushing toward more work. It doesn't validate leisure. It's, in fact, you're bad if you say, you know, I like to sleep 8 hours a night. I really enjoy it. There's something wrong with you somehow.
Yes, you mentioned that.
And I would like to change that. Yeah, I went to this party, and I dared to say that. And it was like, my God, the guy's got leprosy. You know, step away. And I said, no, it's just like I've arranged my life in a certain way, and I've taken the hits for it. You know, I don't have a lot of the stuff you have. But you know what? If I can, I get a good night's sleep.
Well, since we're getting a little philosophical, Mark, I mean, why do you think people in recent years have felt the need to just have all this capital acquisition, to work so hard to get all this stuff that they feel they need to have? I mean, why do you think what do you think it is that's causing people to just want more shit?
Oh, you can't. I mean, look around. I mean, the song of the buyers and the sellers never stops, ever. It never stops. You're weaned to it in this culture from the time you're, you know, old enough to understand what you're listening to. Bigger is always better. More is always more and better. There was this eco-terrorist guy named Ed Abbey years ago who said, you know, perpetual growth is the philosophy of the cancer cell.
Yeah.
It's a good line. But I think that's what the Western, you know, consumer capitalist way is all about. It's perpetual growth. Housing starts are up. Everything is up. Constantly up, up, up. Well, that's a fool's errand. It can't always be up, up, up. It's not going to work. It's not sustainable. We're beginning to learn that it's a steep learning curve. We're having trouble with it. But I think it's every commercial, every ad. You know, you don't have ads on TV for reading a book of poems. You don't have an ad on TV for sitting down with a friend and having a conversation or falling asleep in the hammock. You just don't, because somebody has to pay for the goddamn ad, right?
Yeah.
And the people who pay for the ads are the ones who are trying to sell you stuff so that they're trying to, et cetera. So if everything is going in one direction, and you have a choice. I believe we still have a choice, and that is to choose selectively, intelligently, in a way that's suitable for us, to opt out, to say, okay, I'm going to reserve this bit of time. I'm going to save this chunk of my Sunday. I'm going to do this in July of next year, and then do it. And you'll find that it's actually really hard, because we're so jacked in, we're so addicted, that stepping out is sometimes more painful than staying in.
Well, at the risk of possibly placing you in some sort of advertorial standpoint, given that this book seems to have a philosophy at times of getting out of Brewster, I'm wondering, why should anyone stay in Brewster? What is Brewster's big selling point right now? Sell me on Brewster. give me your elevator pitch.
Chamber of Commerce.
Let's take back some of this advertising language back, and you know.
Brewster is, well, first of all, it's an hour and a quarter from the city, and this is still a hell of a fine city.
Immediately go to the distance. It's exactly Chamber of
Commerce. I go. Yeah. Okay. So. But no, that's something, right? You get on the train. I can walk down the hill. I get on the train like I did with my daughter this morning, and an hour and a quarter later, I'm talking to you. That's a nice thing. I think there's some gorgeous country around there. I mean, you have the reservoirs, you have the woods. It's still cheap. Cheap is good.
What's the leisure like there?
Leisure is good, man. It's like, well, I mean, everybody finds their own form of it, you know. I'm not really such a sports bar kind of guy. There are a lot of sports bar kind of guys, but there are also other people there too. People who will sort of surprise you with where they've been, what they've known, what they think, how they think. You know, if fishing isn't your thing, then, you know, there are good small movie theaters that you can go to, sort of like local, sort of small run theaters. There's stuff happening around there. Katona has some great music scene. You know, I mean, for someone like me, I don't think any place on earth is ever going to satisfy me completely. But Brewster has a lot of the things that work for me. It's authentic. Like I said, it's got sharp elbows, but it's authentic. It doesn't, it's not all purple awnings and, you know, people who sort of, you know, draw the lawyer at every argument. You know, it's like you can have an argument and they may get in your face, but it's kind of human to human. It's not, money hasn't corrupted Brewster yet, and money can sometimes corrupt a place.
So sharp elbows is the way to solve all of American ails.
Well, maybe I prefer sharp words sometimes. Though not always, actually. Maybe sometimes sharp elbows are better. But it's a human place, is what I'd say. It's still on a human scale. Now it's also, I call it Little Quito because we have the largest population, I heard, of Ecuadorians outside of Ecuador itself. Mm-hmm. So it's going through one of those phases. It's, you know, there were the Irish, there were the Italians, they're still there. But now we're going through an Ecuadorian and Honduran phase, which is working itself out. I think it's fascinating. It's my first house. I'm 55, bought my first house, stopped being a gypsy for a while. Living in Brewster.
This is good news for someone like me.
Maybe. Maybe so.
That's a good place to end. Mark, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
This has been terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello.